Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Chuck Collins of the Institute for Policy Studies, who takes a critical look at the recent White House congressional budget deal and the issues of tax fairness not being addressed in the national debate over deficits. Yale Law Professor Bruce Ackerman, who explains why he has written an open letter charging that Army Private Bradley Manning, accused of leaking secret government documents to WikiLeaks, is being subjected to degrading and inhumane treatment. And Kim Ives, an editor with the newspaper Haiti Liberté, who examines the history and political views of Michel Martelly, the victor in Haiti's March 20th second-round presidential election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In early April, tens of thousands of protesters returned to Cairo's Tahrir Square to demonstrate their anger at the slow pace of reform by the country's military-run government. Pro-democracy activists are demanding that ousted President Hosni Mubarak and his allies be arrested and put on trial. Activists also pushed for a quick transition to civilian rule, an end to the official state of emergency, and release of all political prisoners. On April 10th, police cleared out Tahrir Square using tasers and batons, leaving 13 people injured. In recent weeks, the military council, which runs the country, pushed through a constitutional referendum with plans for a transition to civilian rule. Critics and pro-democracy activists called the measure tepid. The Egyptian Center for Trade Unions and Worker Services opposed the referendum through a campaign by students, unions, and human rights groups. Tamer Fathi of the Workers' Center told a news magazine in These Times, "There was insufficient debate. The government was successful in rushing the whole decision and making it unclear." Pro-democracy activists, many of whom are organizing an independent trade union movement, have also condemned a recent proposal by the Egyptian cabinet to ban strikes and protests with stiff sanctions for violations. In the face of deep cuts in social programs by Britain's conservative-led government, a grassroots rebellion has emerged, targeting corporate tax dodgers to recover revenue to pay for housing and other programs. Activists connected through Twitter have orchestrated a direct action campaign against the mobile phone giant Vodafone, who owes billions of British pounds in back taxes. The cell phone giant says it's exempt from paying taxes to Britain since it is based in the low-tax nation of Luxembourg. The new tax commissioner, David Harnett, fueled outrage by writing off £1 billion of the company's back taxes. In London, online activists launched UK Uncut, where protesters have swarmed Vodafone and other tax dodgers' retail outlets. Alex Miller, an organizer, told The Nation magazine that shoppers were very supportive of the action since they worried about losing public services and were furious when they heard that virtually none of this had to happen if the massive corporations paid their taxes. In response to nonviolent civil disobedience at Topshop's largest store in London on the Saturday before Christmas, Prime Minister David Cameron announced a drive against tax avoidance, which has already generated over £2 billion British pounds in revenue. ProPublica reports America's public health system is woefully unprepared for a nuclear emergency such as an accident at a nuclear power plant or the explosion of a dirty bomb by terrorists. A 2010 assessment by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security concluded there is no strategy for notifying the public in real time of recommendations on shelter or evacuation priorities. 2 years ago, the U.S. Strategic National Stockpile stopped buying potassium iodide, the best-known antidote to radioactive-induced thyroid cancer. The drug is only effective if taken within hours of exposure. The decision to stop stockpiling potassium iodide was made after federal officials concluded it would be distributed too late to make a difference during a nuclear emergency. In the aftermath of the crisis at Japan's Fukushima nuclear complex, one of the biggest problems facing local hospitals was that many hospital staff fled the area and the government could not supply food and water to care for patients. During Pennsylvania's Three Mile Island nuclear power plant accident in 1979, an estimated 144,000 people fled the area, disrupting public services and creating a sense of panic. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
there was high drama on Capitol Hill, echoed in the nation's media, as an 11th-hour deal was struck between the Obama White House and Congress to avert a government shutdown over approval of federal funds for the remaining 2011 budget. Of the $38 billion in cuts fought for and won by the GOP that still must be approved by the House and Senate, most were in spending on health, education, transportation, and the environment. Programs affected include community AIDS treatment projects and aid to low-income mothers and children. Other programs taking severe hits were those that funded research into developing renewable energy and energy efficiency, as well as promoting clean drinking water. But larger fights loom over the nation's deficit as Congress will soon confront the necessary increase of the federal debt ceiling and a showdown over the 2012 budget. Republican Congressman Paul Ryan of Wisconsin has called for more than $6.2 trillion in budget cuts, repeal of the Obama health care reform law, the gutting of Medicare and Medicaid, as well as more large tax cuts for the wealthy and corporations. President Obama will lay out his approach in a speech on April 13th that many progressives fear will accept the conservative premise that deep cuts must be made to Social Security and Medicare. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Chuck Collins, director of the Institute for Policy Studies Project on Inequality and the Common Good. Collins talks about his group's new report titled Unnecessary Austerity, which provides a blueprint on how to address the nation's deficit by reversing billions of dollars in tax giveaways to the richest Americans and most profitable corporations.
This whole deficit and debt debate has been constructed. You know, it's not unusual for a country that is at war in several places and has just gone through the worst economic crisis since the Depression to engage in deficit spending in the, you know, December 2008 and early 2009. Some of that spending and monetary policies of the Federal Reserve actually softened the blow, and money going into communities through the stimulus bill, as derided as it is, kept a lot of teachers and firefighters on the job and kept a lot of people at work. And what we're about to do is eliminate those tools from the toolbox at a time when it's still a quite a fragile economic rebound. So, you know, as a percent of our gross domestic product, the amount of our debt is not unusual for a time of war and a time of depression. And there are times when you should borrow and times when you shouldn't. And this would be one of the times when it actually makes sense. Unfortunately, we're borrowing after, a decade of racking up debt that was kind of mistaken. You know, we borrowed money to give tax cuts to the wealthy. We borrowed money to fight the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so we borrowed and squandered, whereas, you know, it might make sense in certain situations to borrow and invest and stimulate the economy, which is what we've done the last couple of years. So it's a dangerous situation because we could go in, you know, with rising fuel costs, rising food costs, we could actually see another economic downturn, but we wouldn't have the political will and we wouldn't have the tools to soften the blow next time around.
Chuck Collins, summarize for us what you found in your group's recent report, Unnecessary Austerity, put out by the Institute for Policy Studies Project on Inequality and the Common Good, that basically refutes the GOP position that America has only a spending problem, while ignoring the revenue side of the equation, where tax cuts for the wealthy have increased the tax burden on working and middle-class families.
Yeah. You know, the pinch we're in has two parts of it. One is that income and wealth has concentrated at the top, you know, in the top 1% of households in a way that we haven't seen since the 1920s, and that at the same time we've stopped taxing the top. So huge amounts of money going to the top, but we're not taxing it. We're not taxing corporations and individuals at the same level that we were any time in the last couple of decades. And we actually looked, it was interesting to look at 1961, go back 50 years, the year Barack Obama was born. If millionaires today paid the same rate, effective rate that they paid in 1961, and million-dollar corporations earning a million or more paid at the same rate that they paid in 1961, our Treasury would raise another $716 billion a year, which is $7 trillion over 10 years. So that's just an example that the tax code has gotten more regressive, meaning, you know, lower-income people, middle-income people are carrying a greater part of the responsibility, and the wealthy and global corporations are paying less. So You know, there are a number of reasons for that, but we've essentially been cutting taxes on the top. If you were a millionaire in 1961, you paid an effective rate of about 43% of your income in taxes. And if you're a millionaire today, you pay about 23%. And if you earn $50,000, you pay about 21%. So it's not that different. So one very simple remedy to this whole austerity thing is just reverse some of the tax cuts, and particularly close some of these corporate tax loopholes. I mean, Scott, you pay more taxes than General Electric, Boeing, Verizon, ExxonMobil, Federal Express all put together. Those companies use offshore tax havens. They play accounting games to avoid paying any taxes. And before we make any more drastic cuts, maybe those corporations should pay their fair share.
Chuck, a couple of the big showdowns that are going to be occurring on Capitol Hill revolve around increasing the federal debt limit and the 2012 budget plans already unveiled by Republican Representative Paul Ryan that would phase out Medicare and slash Medicaid, so these programs would not even be recognizable, programs that are very popular with the entire country. How do you see the Obama administration playing this game of chicken here with the Republicans, who seem to hold, you know, things like Planned Parenthood hostage if they can't get their way, and just taking these kind of cultural war issues and injecting them into the budget issues?
Based on this sort of first run-through of the show, it's not going to be great because, you know, the Obama administration is going to really have to say, look, we're going to draw the line. We're not going to, like, cut services for the most vulnerable. I mean, if you just do a quick gleaning of, you know, mental health services, childhood health care, immunization, all these things that actually hit the most vulnerable people in our society, you have to basically draw your line and not cross it and hold the line and go to the American people and say, look, we don't have to make these cuts. We can raise this revenue. You know, President Obama was one of the co-sponsors of the Stop Tax Haven Abuse legislation that closed down some of these offshore tax havens and would generate $100 billion of revenue. We could institute a financial speculation tax on Wall Street and generate $150 billion a year. There are other options out there, and the president needs to be both a champion of revenue as well as a kind of moral voice on these issues of what kind of budget cuts aren't going to be acceptable. He's going to have to find his voice in this battle. And the fact is, the American people will, you know, probably rally behind him if he can make a compelling argument. But if he just stays in the deficit austerity framework, then we're in for tough times.
That was Chuck Collins, director of the Institute for Policy Studies Project on Inequality and the Common Good. Find a link to his group's report, Unnecessary Austerity, on our website at btlonline.org. As accused WikiLeaks whistleblower, Army Specialist Bradley Manning spends his 10th month in solitary confinement at the Marine Brig in Quantico, Virginia. His treatment has aroused opposition on many fronts. Bloggers at Fire Dog Lake have taken up his cause, and the author Greg Mitchell just published a book about Manning, whose trial date has not yet been set. And in the April 28th issue of the New York Review of Books, Yale Law Professor Bruce Ackerman and Harvard Law Professor Yochai Benkler published a letter of concern that has already been signed by 300 academics, mostly law professors, calling on the Obama administration to end the military's abusive treatment of Manning or justify its conduct, which many experts say amounts to torture. In addition to being held in solitary confinement, Manning has been regularly stripped naked and provided only with a special anti-suicide smock to wear in his cell, conditions that human rights groups, including Amnesty International, believe may violate his rights. Juan Mendez, a Switzerland-based United Nations rapporteur on torture, has requested, but thus far has not been allowed, to visit Manning in prison to make an unmonitored assessment of his treatment. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Yale Law Professor Bruce Ackerman about why he wrote the letter and what effect he hopes it will have.
Yochai Benkler and I have been following the case, and it did seem that things were getting worse and worse, and that it was time to actually try to organize a scholarly community to make a statement on it. And so that's what we did. I was very pleased that they saw a need to stand up for this. I should say that this letter is by no means the only or maybe even the most important thing that's being done. I think that there's this fellow named Juan Mendez from the United Nations who is trying to have an interview with Private Manning. And so far, the United States government hasn't allowed him to have an interview with him. And yesterday, he issued a statement complaining about that. And so there are quite a few organizational efforts. It should be also emphasized that we really don't know the facts. Our letter of concern was based upon the presentation of the facts by Manning's lawyer. It's going on 10 months now. He is in maximum security, even though he says that he's been, his reports say that he's a model prisoner. And then he has been exposed to really very extreme measures as a suicide risk. So he is placed in solitary confinement for 23 hours a day, and then he is allowed in his cell, and then he is allowed 1 hour to walk in a room by himself. Whenever he dozes off during the day, every 5 minutes he's asked, are you okay? And at night he's stripped bare and he's given a smock. And whenever he turns his back to the jailers or puts a cover over his head, they say, are you all right? So this is very, very extreme stuff here. And, but we don't know what the facts are.
You mean you're saying Manning's lawyer is saying this, but you have no other source of information?
And the U.S. government has not tried publicly to refute it. And that's really what we're demanding. These allegations can't just go on indefinitely if this treatment for 10 months, after all. And he hasn't been put to trial. He has not been convicted of anything. This is, if it's true, an obvious violation of fundamental due process principles and a violation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. If it's true, and if it isn't true, well then, the U.S. government should explain its conduct and justify it. You know, we just can't just go along without a trial and just expose this fellow to these conditions and then bar a United Nations investigator from a meeting with Manning.
So, Bruce Ackerman, what do you hope your letter accomplishes?
That's the point, to express our concern and to insist that this cannot be allowed to continue. Either these conditions have to be radically revised, or we have to have a clear statement of what the facts are and why the Marine Corps in Quantico, where he's being held, think that this is justified. The Secretary of the Navy should be, and I'm told he is, investigating. He should move quickly to really investigate this situation.
What do you think about how the Obama administration has handled this?
There is no evidence that this very restrictive and extreme treatment is being done for the good of Private Manning. It's possible, of course, that Private Manning is suicidal and certain steps have to be taken. It's possible, but nothing of the kind has been shown. And Private Manning alleges that his Army psychiatrist has said that he is not a suicide risk. So, at the present time, from what we can tell, there is one obvious reason for this going on, which is to induce Private Manning to say something that would strengthen the case against Assange.
That was Bruce Ackerman, professor of law and political science at Yale University. Find links to Ackerman's open letter concerning Bradley Manning and other related articles on our website at btlonline.org. Haiti's November 28, 2010 presidential and legislative elections, conducted in the impoverished nation still trying to recover from the devastating January 2010 earthquake that killed an estimated 300,000, were labeled by many as deeply flawed. The balloting was criticized for its very low voter turnout, violent demonstrations, and accusations of widespread fraud, as well as manipulation of the outcome by the United States. The two candidates who moved on to compete in the March 20th second round election were bawdy singer Michelle Sweet Mickey Martelli and Merland Manigat, a former first lady and senator. Election results announced on April 5th reported that Michelle Martelli won a landslide victory with nearly 68% of the vote, while Merland Manigat winning less than 32%. Martelli, who was admitted to regularly smoking crack cocaine and became famous for his stage act of pulling down his pants in concert, had campaigned on a pledge to rein in widespread corruption and channel assistance to the hundreds of thousands of Haitians made homeless by the earthquake. As he takes office on May 14th, Martelli will have questionable legitimacy, given that the nation's most popular political party, Famille-Lavalas, was excluded from competing in the election, leading to over 75% of Haitian voters boycotting the vote. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Kim Ives, an editor with the newspaper Haiti Liberté, who examines the history and political views of President-elect Martelli and the role of former twice-ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who returned to Haiti from 7 years in exile on March 18th.
Well, the second round went more smoothly, one can say, than the first. There were not the cases of violence and chaos and people grabbing ballot boxes and dumping them in the street and stuffing ballots in, etc., that one had in the first round. I mean, the first round was a complete joke and should have been just annulled. But essentially, this whole election has been, from start to finish, what Haitians call a masquerade or a selection. And the joke kind of was on President René Préval, who I think he thought he could work it so that the selection would be his candidate, but the U.S. had another idea, and that was Michel Martelly. Even though the Provisional Electoral Council named Préval's candidate in second place in December, giving it to Jude Celestin, who was the official party's candidate, the OAS intervened on behalf of the U.S. and essentially said, no, no, it should be Michel Martelly, who came in a close third. And hence, Celestin was essentially forced out. Martelly was put in, and then the electoral engineering machinery went into work. Now, people saw that this was essentially a selection by the U.S., and hence were completely uninterested, also because of the fact that the Lavalas Family Party, the largest party, the party of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, was excluded. So over 75% of the voting public stayed away from the polls. And so you hear that Michel Martelly won with 67% of the vote. Well, in fact, that was 67% of about 23% of people who came out, meaning that it was, in fact, 16% of the electorate that voted him in. So it's a very weak mandate and was a very brazen takeover of the Haitian electoral process, in essence, an electoral coup.
Kim, give us some background on Michel Martelly, Haiti's new president. I think many of our listeners will be acquainted with the fact that for years he's been a singer. Part of his act was pulling down his pants and talking a lot of obscene junk from the stage. How did a guy like that become president of Haiti?
Well, yeah, the immorality is something that rankles a lot of Haitians. That's one side, but really the more troubling and scary is the political pedigree of him. He was essentially the cheerleader of the 1991 coup d'etat, would go out in front of the demonstrations organized by the army that overthrew democratically elected President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and sing songs and, very apparently, according to some, he even went around with the death squads at the time. The FRAP death squad was out and had a big hand in contributing to the 5,000 Haitians who were killed during that coup. And he has made the army's restoration really a centerpiece. The Army is in fact already remobilizing. We had an article this week in Haiti Liberté. It's apparently one of about 10 around the country where the FAD actually drills and trains and is preparing for their reemergence. But here's a guy who, in fact, even here in New York, I'm told by a Haitian policeman on my way down to cover the election that in the 67th precinct here in New York, he was arrested for assault and battery for beating up a guy called Sean Dominique, a promoter. He had some differences with him in the organizing up of an event. So here's a guy who has a very thuggish, a very dangerous and sort of aggressive background, and now he's a president. So this doesn't bode well for a lot of the popular organizations and militants, which may well end up being in his crosshairs.
Kim, tens of thousands of people came out to celebrate the return of twice ousted, very popular president Jean Bertrand Aristide. From what your understanding is, what role do you think Jean Bertrand Aristide will now play in Haiti with Martelly as president? What will Aristide be doing, you think, over the next few months as Martelly implements his very conservative neoliberal policies?
Well, he said he's come back to just focus on education. He has the Aristide Foundation for Democracy is still there, the building. And then there is, of course, the university which he built. Education is his passion. However, I think he's also a symbol. He is a sort of Nelson Mandela-like figure. In Haiti, he symbolizes people's power. His presence inspires people and gives them hope, and etc. So I think the Martelly regime will very quickly come after him. So no matter what, in the coming period, Lavalas and Aristide will be lightning rods for the political confrontations in the coming weeks.
That was Kim Ives, an editor at the Haiti Liberté newspaper. Find links to Ives' articles about Haiti on our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Vanzari.